All right, I'll just stay put this morning. I'm going to stay right here all morning, so I like to move around. So if you start to drift off to sleep, just stand up and say, would you move for a minute? I checked the battery, but I didn't check the sound. It got changed. I have to go over here for a second and put this up. I'll be right back. Spend all weekend with you. So I was just letting that sink in. Great. I forgot to mention, I did want to mention this morning before we get started, this Wednesday is Ash Wednesday. Lent begins this week, and in a lot of ways this morning is going to kind of segue into a series of messages that you'll hear over the next several weeks during Lent, where you know, this time of year is not exactly the most encouraging, uplifting topics, because it's the time of year that we really wrestle and are confronted with our sin. We don't like to talk about sin very much in this day and age. Not that it was ever a super popular topic, but especially over the next 7 or 8 weeks, we're just going to really reflect on the power of sin in our world. Because I believe that until you reflect on the reality of sin, you can't fully appreciate God's grace. That's what Paul's message is. Until you reflect on just how much we've all been affected by sin, we really can't come to terms with how much God has done for us in our lives, and I think we'll begin to see that this morning. So we won't have an Ash Wednesday service here, but if you have the opportunity to partake in one and just kind of begin the Lenten season in an appropriate way as you begin to just spend a special time of the year reflecting on your humanity and on what God is doing in your life. This morning, I want us to think about when we, those of you who teach the Bible, whether it's in a class or just to your children or to your family, anytime you teach or preach, you have a tendency to focus on the things that you know the best. I try very, very hard to be as, what's the right word, to cover as many different topics through the Bible as we can. There's 66 books in the Bible, and I like to think that every 5 or 6 years we cover most of them. And so hopefully there's not a lot of topics that you feel like we've never talked about, but inevitably you tend to migrate towards the areas that you are most comfortable with, that you are most familiar with. We are a church who loves the Bible, and we hope that people who are visiting or people who come our way see that they know that we know the Bible. That we love the Bible, we try to be people of the Bible, we try to follow it as best we can. I'm not saying we rub it in anybody's face or beat anybody over the head with it, but that they just realize, oh, okay, this book you keep going to, which back in the day we used to carry those big old thick bonded leather Bibles, now we just have these things, so they don't know if we're playing Angry Birds or reading the Bible. Clark, you still play Angry Birds? Sorry, that's just a joke between us. Anyways, sometimes, though, I think we have to come to terms with the fact that there's a lot of things in the Bible. As well as we may know it, as much as we may have studied it, you may have degrees in Bible, you may have taken college classes in Bible, you may have been studying the Bible for 50 years, but there's still a lot of stuff in there that you ain't got a clue about and that I ain't got a clue about. And we don't like to admit it because we'd rather focus on the things that we do know a lot about. It's like we create this big kind of wall of understanding, a big kind of tower of theology, and it becomes our window or our paradigm by which we understand everything else. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's how we construct theology. We have the Bible in front of us, and we do the best to try to figure out how it all kind of goes together, the story it tells. But inevitably, no matter what your theology might be, whatever your understanding might be, there are things that are in the Bible that don't fit very well. That's just the way that it is. And we don't really like to admit that because we like to be wrong and we like to know what we're talking about. But there are things that don't fit. There are things that we just don't understand. I've been reading stories in the Bible just this week that I know I have read 100 times. And I read it and I go, I don't ever remember seeing that. And you could probably nod your head and go, yeah, I know, you know, you see things differently. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean, I something very literal, I'm like, I don't ever remember seeing that ever before in my life. God is constantly revealing things to us, and we just, I think we really challenge to get our minds around all of this. Perfect example of this is speaking in tongues. Like, there's a whole chapter in the New Testament about speaking in tongues. And most of us just kind of go, yeah, it's in there. And we just kind of kick it over to the side because it doesn't fit into our understanding or into our experience. Not everybody, but a lot of Christians, it just doesn't really fit. I mean, it's right there in black and white in the passage, but we just have difficulty fitting that into our theology. The last couple of Sunday or Tuesdays in our Bible study, Bill Dameron has brought up one. He said, hey, what's the deal with this? It's in 1 Samuel, what is it, about 16. The Bible talks about the Spirit of the Lord comes off of Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord falls and torments Saul. What is that about? We kick it to the side because it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit into our understanding. This week I read this passage, Exodus chapter 4. I know I have read this before. I'm sure that I have. Exodus 4, beginning in verse 24. On the way to Egypt, at a place where Moses and his family had stopped for the night, the Lord confronted him and was about to kill him. But Moses' wife Zipporah took a flint knife and circumcised her son. She touched his feet with the foreskin and said, I didn't get the slides done in time, sorry about that, and said, now you're a bridegroom of the blood to me. And what she meant by a bloodgroom of bride was she was referring to circumcision. After that, the Lord let him alone. What? The Lord was about to kill Moses? Like, why have I never seen this before? Why have I never stopped and thought, what is going on? It's like watching Back to the Future chapter 4, where we go, what happens if Moses isn't there to lead the people through the Red Sea and he never approaches Pharaoh and none of these? Why was the Lord angry with him? I don't know, but it's one of those passages that we just, it's not part, I see it's driving me crazy. I have to stay by the mic. But we just kick it to the side and we're just like, I don't, let's just not talk about that. As much as we try to get our mind around every little detail, every little teaching, make it fit into some nice little textbook that we can throw out there, sometimes I think that we don't allow enough room for the mysteriousness of God. That there are just some things we're not going to understand. And it's a fine line to walk, because a lot of critics of Christianity and a lot of critics of religion will say, well, they kind of characterize it as a God of the gaps. Oh, well, if you don't understand it, you just claim that it's God, and that solves it. And that, of course, was a big modus operandi in the past, where people didn't understand why the clouds brought rain and how the system, they didn't have Channel 4 to tell us, you know, the exact parameters of the weather that they nail every single time. And so they just assigned it to God. And so it's an easy kind of excuse, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just living in the reality that we don't understand everything about God, and we never, ever will. I think one of the things that we've struggled with is the idea that God is sovereign. In a lot of Christian traditions, they talk a lot about the sovereignty of God. Our tradition particularly, we don't talk about it very much. And it's one of those highfalutin theology words. We've been talking about this in our class on Sundays. Sometimes we get lost in these kind of elevated academic words, and we think, oh, that's just a discussion for smart people. But no, even the sophisticated conversations about how we understand God, they have real life implications into our understanding of things. And I think this is one of them. That we don't talk enough about the sovereignty of God to be able to see the world and say, yeah, I understand a lot about how the world works, but ultimately, God is the one who's in charge. In his systematic theology, Stanley Grenz says this: biblical history, beginning with the Garden of Eden and climaxing in the coming of the Son, is a testimony to the sovereignty of the Father. Like, that's what the whole Bible's about. And yet we sometimes don't stop and consider the implications of that. Sovereignty can be defined as supreme power or authority, the ultimate, the highest power. We often refer to God as omnipotent or omniscient. Our belief in God as the ultimate, highest power has real life implications for how we live and how we see the world. At the end of the day, every day, we should be asking ourselves, do I truly believe that the most powerful entity that exists anywhere, any place, any time, that he's really, truly in charge of this place? Because there are plenty of things around us that make us wonder about that sometimes. Two police officers show up at the front door of a hang-up 911 call and get shot, and you just start to wonder, what is going on in this world? Is God in control? Is he all-powerful? I think if I do my job right this morning, you're going to at least leave here questioning some things that you have thought about God in the past. You're going to at least ask yourself some new questions. As I thought about it this morning, leading up to this morning, I thought, you know, there probably should be more sermons when we leave feeling the warmth of God more intimately than ever before, while at the same time shaking our heads more confused and in greater awe than we ever thought possible. Like, we emphasize, yeah, we feel the love of God, but how often do we leave our messages or our song service or our worship time and just shake our head and think, God is, I don't even have words today. He's so big, he's so powerful. I'm afraid that too often we leave and think, man, I feel better. And somehow we make it about ourselves. Yeah, I just wasn't feeling worship today. Wow. Who cares? It wasn't about you in the first place. It was about the sovereign God of the world. Today, our message comes from the most powerful man at the time and one of the most powerful men in the world. His name, of course, we have no idea, but he was known simply as Pharaoh. He was the political leader of Egypt, the king, for all intents and purposes. But he was more than that. He was God in the flesh. The Egyptians had this concept that Pharaoh was a god, that he was deity. He might not have been equal to the deity of the river and fertility and some of the other gods they worship, but he was kind of the go-between. He was the most powerful entity that was able to interact with them. The book of Exodus begins with a statement of just how powerful Pharaoh was in chapter 1, verse 22. He orders every baby boy born to the Israelites to be thrown into the Nile River. If we're going to talk about the sovereignty of God, then we're going to have to pretty quickly talk about Pharaoh, who was looked upon as the sovereign leader of Egypt. Exodus kind of unfolds as this drama between Pharaoh and Moses, between the Egyptians and the Israelites. But it's really not about Moses, and it's really not about the Israelites. And so often we read the story as such, but we miss the point. The story is about God. Remember in Exodus chapter 3, when Moses sees the burning bush, and God calls him from that bush, one of the first things Moses does is ask him, who are you? What's your name? And I want to present to you that the rest of the book of Exodus is God answering the question for him. You want to know who I am? Let me tell you who I am. It's not about plagues. It's not about slavery. It's not about Moses' leadership. I mean, it is about all of those things, but at a much lower level. Ultimately, the story, which really is the crux of the Old Testament, the story of Pharaoh and the plagues and the Passover, this is the climax of the Old Testament. Everything that comes after is going to look back to this moment. But it's really about God. It's a story about God's sovereignty, about whether or not he's sovereign over these people, over all the world, and it's also a story about what happens to people who get in his way. Listen to Exodus chapter 4, beginning in verse 18. Moses went back home to Jethro, his father-in-law. Please let me return to my relatives in Egypt, Moses said. I don't even know if they're still alive. Go in peace, Jethro replied. And before Moses left Midian, the Lord said to him, return to Egypt, for all those who wanted to kill you have died. So Moses took his wife and his sons, put them on a donkey, headed back to the land of Egypt. In his hand, he carried the staff of God. And the Lord said to Moses, when you arrive back in Egypt, go to Pharaoh and perform all the miracles I have empowered you to do. But I will harden his heart so he will refuse to let the people go. Then you will tell him, this is what the Lord says, Israel is my firstborn son. I commanded you, let my son go so he can worship me, but since you have refused, I will now kill your firstborn son also. It's a rather amazing passage to read, knowing everything that's about to take place. And just like that story about God wanting to kill Moses at the very beginning of all this, I think we just as quickly read over this passage and all the implications of it. It's almost like God is telling Moses that the whole thing is rigged, right? This whole game is rigged. I want you to go to Pharaoh and I want you to ask for him to send the people away, but he's not going to do it. And if you're Moses, you got to be thinking, well, then why am I going to go through the trouble of doing it? Like, what's the point? From the very beginning, he says, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, so he's not going to relent, but I still want you to go up there. It's like your kid's asking you, I can't do it, it's impossible. We'll just do it anyways. And of course, like all of us, Moses would say, why? Just do it. And that's what I think that's in the parenting handbook. You have to say that 100 times a day. Just do it, because I said so. But this seems pointless. It seems silly. Why should he go if God is telling Moses before this whole process ever started, I'm going to harden his heart? And the story begins that way. It's kind of like that evil spirit sent on Saul, Bill. Why? Like, why would you do this, Pharaoh? Why would you do this to Pharaoh? I don't get it. And then when you begin to read the story, and you get there's kind of a cadence to the story. We know the 10 plagues. Let me quickly run through what happens. So God tells Moses and Aaron to go before Pharaoh. The initial request: I want you to go tell him that he wants to drive his people out. And Exodus chapter 7, verse 3, but I'll harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt, he's not going to listen to you. Then I'll lay my hands on Egypt with a mighty axe of judgment. And so Aaron threw down the staff, and the reaction to Aaron's staff, yet Pharaoh's heart became hard. He wouldn't listen to him, just like the Lord said. I mean, it's like we've read the end of the story already. Now we're going to have to live it all out. And then, of course, the plagues begin. The first plague, the Nile, is turned to blood. In verse 22, but the Egyptian magicians did the same thing by their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he wouldn't listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord said. Then the frogs came in chapter 18 and verse 15. When Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart, and he wouldn't listen to Moses. Then the gnats came, but Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he wouldn't listen, just as the Lord said. Then the flies came, but this time also Pharaoh hardened his heart and wouldn't let his people go. Then the livestock were afflicted. Pharaoh sent men to investigate and found that not even one of the animals of the Israelites had died, yet his heart was unyielding and he wouldn't let his people go. Then the boils came, affecting the very livelihood of the people, but still the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart and he wouldn't listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said. The seventh plague was hail. He and his officials hardened their hearts. Then the locusts came, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. Then darkness came, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. And at the end of this onslaught in Exodus chapter 11, verse 10, we get this summary statement. Moses and Aaron performed all of these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart and he would not let the Israelites go out of his country. I mean, if you're reading it without that little caveat at the very beginning, you just keep asking the question, Pharaoh, what is your problem? How can you allow all this destruction to come? How can you allow all of this death to come? How can you put up with all of this? But we've already read the story. We knew this was going to happen. And so it brings up a million questions about God, does it not? Why would God let this happen? And then on top of that, finally, after the death of the firstborn affects all of Egypt, the Pharaoh washes his hands and says, okay, just go. Just go. And then Yahweh tells Moses in chapter 14, verse 4, I will harden Pharaoh's heart again, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the Israelites did this. Chapter 14, verse 8, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. I mean, imagine the Egyptians on this death march toward the sea, knowing that this was feeble. After all they had witnessed, after all they had undergone, to get the command from the highest of high, pursue them. knowing that it's folly. And those of us who are worshipers of Yahweh are begging the question of him, what about Pharaoh's free will? Doesn't he have a say in this? Now, a lot of people will want to point to the way that the plagues are described. And the first four or five of them, it said that Pharaoh hardened his heart. And then the language changes toward the end that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. And that's noteworthy, but we've already read in chapter 4 that God was predicting this all along, that God was going, or that Moses was going to harden his heart, and that God was going to harden his heart. That's it. What about all of the unnecessary lives that were lost and all the unnecessary destruction that took place? We often don't think in terms of salvation when it comes to the unfolding plans of Israel in the Old Testament, but what about the salvation of the Egyptians? What about all those who lost their lives seemingly following a false leader? And just like I said at the beginning of this message, there are so many questions that we just don't really get the answer to in this passage. It's the side of God that we don't often talk about. It's the sovereignty, that God's sovereign over all this world. We like to think about how God is working in my life and whether he's going to be with me tomorrow and through my day tomorrow and whether he's going to give me a safe travel. And we talked about specific prayer requests this morning that we're going to raise to him. And all of that, of course, has a place. But seldom do we consider how God is at work in the bigger players of our world, among nations, among powers and principalities throughout this entire world, that he is behind them too. Somehow, some way in the mystery. It brings to mind The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that great scene from C.S. Lewis where Mr. Tumnus the Beaver is confronted by Lucy about the Aslan, the Christ figure, and Lucy asks him, is he safe? And Mr. Tumnus' great answer said, safe? Who said anything about safe? But he's good. God is at work in a mighty and powerful way in the Egyptians, among his people Israel. This whole story is about God sending a message to the world and to the people. How many times did it say that Pharaoh hardened his heart just like the Lord said? As if to emphasize the point of this is who's really in charge. This is who is really calling the shots, because nobody else was certain about that. The Egyptians were sure that the Pharaoh was God and that he had this deal going on with the other gods and that's how the world was undergoing things. Israel, they weren't really sure. They were just kind of confused about whether or not anybody could ever challenge the power of this Pharaoh who had so oppressed him. And so God comes along, and in a lot of ways, he kind of plays mouse with Pharaoh and the people. I mean, he's just toying with them. And it makes us a little uncomfortable, because the God that we oftentimes envision is soft and cuddly, and he's our pal, and he's there for us, and certainly he has that part to him. But God is sovereign. He hears the cry of the oppressed, those in need of liberation. He challenges those who make a big name for themselves. He calls into question their power. Paul saw the significance of this reality when he was writing Romans, and it prompted him to ask this powerful rhetorical question, if God is for us, then who can be against us? Certainly he has in mind that amazing picture from Israel, of Egypt, of God performing all of these amazing and miraculous signs. There are many things that are going to come our way and challenge and question the sovereignty of God in our lives. Inevitably, we may not frame the question that way, we may not frame the challenge that way, but ultimately those are the challenges that we face. From the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, wasn't that the role of the serpent, calling into question the sovereignty of God? Did God really say, and then calling into question his character? He just thinks that you want to be like him, and he doesn't want that. Those promises linger and itch our ears today from so many places. America is intoxicated with power, with greatness, with its military, with its might of economy. And all of these things call into question whether God is sovereign or not. Do you trust in those things, or do you trust in God? And so this morning I wanted to end with just reminding us that God is more powerful than the president. He's more powerful than Congress. He's more powerful than our military. He's more powerful than the incredible military parades of North Korea. He's more powerful than Apple or Nike or any other major corporation. He's more powerful than pornography or alcohol or drugs or other addictions. He's more powerful than aches and pains or depression. He's more powerful than apathy or disinterest or lukewarmness. God can do everything, and there's no one that can stop him. And even in all of his power, and even in all of his might, and even in all of his authority, and even the fact that he's sovereign over this world, he loves you and me. He forgives us of our sins. He is patient with your unbelief and mine. He desires you to be with him. And for whatever reason, and it doesn't fit into my box very well, and so I'll just kick it over to the side of the stage. The Pharaoh didn't fit into the God's plan as being one of his chosen people. It's one of the deep and confounding mysteries of Scripture. But of course, the resounding message that we all need to hear this morning is that while Pharaoh was not part of God's chosen people, you are. The great Creator wants nothing more than to have a relationship with you, to fill your life with power and meaning and significance. You were created in his image, and he wants to be with you. If you haven't found a relationship with him, this morning is a great a time as any to reassess things, to start to think things over and think things through. It's just not often enough do we think about the grandeur and majesty of God. Like when we say that we're all in with God, we've given our lives over to him, just consider what we're saying. He's the great power. There's nothing that can come our way. As you go on and read the end of Romans 8, it's a powerful statement that Paul says, there's nothing that can separate us from the love of God. And when you add that with the great and sovereign power that he is, man, that's a reason to smile every day. That's a reason to be reminded that we're gonna be okay. We're gonna be all right. This morning we end and hopefully can keep that in our minds as we sing this last song of reminder of the greatness of God, if you'll stand with us this morning.